In today's episode of Private Stories, I speak to Alex Generous, who tells me her story of living with autism spectrum disorder. I'm Dr. Becky Spellman. I'm a registered psychologist and director of Private Therapy Clinic, a company where we support people with all types of psychological difficulties and therapeutic goals. What did you notice from a really early age that was difficult for you? So early life difficulties.
I noticed that a lot of the adults around me were unhappy. I noticed that for some reason that I was sad a lot, but I didn't quite know why. And I didn't know that what was going on around me was abuse. So it was normalized for me. Anytime anyone felt a very strong emotion, usually that's what I notice.
Right. Okay. And you mentioned you didn't notice what was going on around you was abuse. So does that mean you were in situations that were very abusive from a young age?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that when you have a disability, you're more likely to be abused. So I was being sexually abused at home and also psychologically and verbally abused. Yeah. So I would be bullied and taunted by family members a lot. Mm-hmm. And at school, I would be bullied for being weird, but that seemed like the least of my problems at the time. So it wasn't as ridiculous, but it wasn't pleasant, but luckily I was able to leave home from a pretty young age. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have to stay with it for that long.
Yeah. So you really experienced some really harsh difficulties from a young age, and then communicating these to anyone must have been very difficult.
It was. And what's even more difficult is that my family, at the time they were well respected and they were very wealthy and they were in a circle of friends that there's nothing I really could have done or said that would have changed much, unfortunately. But luckily, a few times, Child Protective Services was sent to my home, but nothing ever happened of it. And I don't know how it is in the UK, but the foster system and all of the even mental health care, it's just not that great.
For females who have autism spectrum disorder, it's incredibly hard to diagnose, which is tremendously difficult when people don't have a diagnosis that can then help them get the right support. So how old were you when you got diagnosed?
I was 12 years old. To be honest, I was so unhappy at the time. At that point, I didn't care what my new diagnosis was because I'd had diagnoses thrown at me my whole life. My whole childhood, they thought I was bipolar and ADHD, but really I was just surrounded by imbeciles.
Yeah.
Rather than.
Yeah.
But for my family, though, it was a sigh of relief because they kind of finally understood what was wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And were able to find me, as you said before, the right resources to treat the diagnosis. Once you know what's wrong, you know how to treat it, I guess.
Yeah. The bipolar diagnosis is an interesting one. Why did they think that was initially the correct diagnosis for you?
I would have a lot of tantrums because of my sensory integration issues.
Mm-hmm.
And also, there were really no structure or boundaries at home. And on top of just being ridiculed and embarrassed all the time, I could have easily had symptoms based on environment alone.
Yeah.
But there's also a genetic predisposition. So people thought that I would be more likely to have bipolar because my grandpa had it. So I think that is kind of what leaned it. But the hard thing was being medicated for diagnoses you don't have as a child. There were a lot of side effects. I was always tired. I remember one of my birthday parties, I fell asleep for half of it because the drugs just were too much. And then I got yelled at by my brother for sleeping through my birthday party. Like stuff like that. Like, other people think you're just misbehaving or being lazy, but, and then another time my jaw locked up and I had to be taken to the hospital to get a shot to treat it. And that was from too much risperdal.
Tell me about the sensory issues for people who don't understand this very well. Tell me about how certain senses that you're affected by certain things.
I'll get, so we have our senses, and with sensory integration, a few of your senses are really heightened and the others may be normal or less developed, but basically it's never like all five senses are super heightened. It's like a couple. For me, it's taste and touch. So that was very difficult for me to process new things and to touch certain fabrics.
So let's get really specific about this, because I'd like people to understand this to the most they possibly can. So you made a very interesting point that it's different for different people. It's never all five senses for an individual. So for you, it's very specifically touch and very specifically taste. So what kind of tastes were overwhelming for you or that you'd have kind of a strong negative reaction to?
It wasn't so much the taste as much as it was the texture of the foods. So what I didn't like were like three or four different textures mixed into one thing. Like Mexican food, there's a lot of enchiladas and other stuff where it's like, every food component has different textures and they're all thrown in together. So that's what upset me. It isn't so much like the taste of the individual things. It's I was one of those weird people who didn't like the food touching or the components of it touching, but eventually
Very well described. I
didn't go out of it because I still struggle with it. But I definitely have become a lot more tolerant as the years go on.
So if I've got this right, you prefer a food that has a consistent texture. So it's pretty much like the same texture. If it has the mixture of different textures, would you say that that's something that's like irritating for you? Or would you say there's a different kind of reaction that you get?
It's irritating. But it's not only that, it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. And would that be like, as it's kind of, you can feel it touching your mouth, that it's that sensation is like something.
Induces the gag reflux. So that's, and like I said, it's not the taste so much as the combination of textures, because the moment you place it on your tongue, you can feel the different consistencies. And if you're not used to it, it's a little bit frustrating.
Would you feel like you need to vomit if like you get this unpleasant texture combination?
I wouldn't get to that point so much, because I would refuse to eat it in the first place. And like, my parents didn't force me to eat certain foods.
And for some people that can come across as very unusual, because it's like the majority of people just wouldn't make those comments, and therefore people can be very judgmental about someone having these preferences because they don't know what their experience is like, and therefore they think someone's being difficult or a bit unusual, or like, why can't you just handle it? Like, people can be extremely dismissive when they don't understand someone's experience. Did you experience a lot of those comments, very negative comments about your preferences when you were growing up?
Yes, when I would go like eat at friends' house, in order to stop eating it, I would just tell them that I'm allergic to the things in it. But that's when I was like a kid. And also, I did receive that negativity. I had people make fun of me for my food choices. Ironically, in all cases, it was adults that made fun of me for and judge me, not other kids. And it was always just kind of passed off that I was a difficult child.
Yeah, which is such a, it's such a horrible assumption for people to make, that you were just being difficult as if you had a choice over what to like and what not to like. And they didn't know that your internal experience was, this is actually extremely unpleasant for me. Tell me about fabrics. So fabrics that were, that would cause a negative reaction for you. What fabrics were, would kind of evoke that reaction for you?
Velvet and the feel of towels. Mm-hmm. Luckily, I've grown out of that. But I definitely don't seek those sensations, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like if I see velvet in car seat interiors, I won't put my hands on it. I'll just put my hands on my lap so I don't have to touch it. Mm-hmm. I kind of want wearing gloves to become mainstream again, like it was for decades, because I feel like, especially with COVID, that's just more hygienic and it dulls some of those senses.
Yeah. How did you become to kind of tolerate that texture of velvet a bit more as you got older?
Systematic desensitization. I would, so when I finally left home for boarding school when I was 12. At that point, it wasn't like my parents feeding me, it was other people feeding me. So I was put in a lot of situations where I was forced to encounter new food. Yeah. I was really skinny because I wouldn't eat that much. Mm-hmm. But over time, I became more and more open to try new things. Right. And there would be some situations where people like wouldn't let me leave the table unless I ate certain things.
That must have been really distressing for you to essentially be forced to get used to things and tolerate things that were incredibly uncomfortable for you.
Well, those are the structure and the boundaries that should have been put in place from early on in my childhood. If those were in place, I wouldn't have been dealing with it when I was 12 or 13.
So when you got the diagnosis, did you start getting support that was helpful, or did that come much later in life?
So at the time, I was in like a hospital, like a psychiatric hospital for kids. And it was a waiting game, meaning there were residential boarding schools that specialize in these sorts of issues, but there was a waiting period. So I'd be held at different places until then. And it's really disturbing what happens in like children's wards and adolescent wards. I guess it was more traumatizing for me to see the way people were being treated than it was me being like, yay, I got my autism diagnosis. Now I can get the tools I need. There wasn't any of that enthusiasm. It was just what was put in front of me at the time.
How long did you spend as an inpatient as a child?
From when I was 12 until I was 15. And then I joined just a regular boarding school and went to like a regular college.
Right.
And so like I was able to assimilate back into life by the time I was 15. But there was like a bunch of trauma and other stuff that remained undealt with that none of my, very few of my peers could relate to.
Yeah. Yeah. It was an extremely extreme situation for you to be placed in. When actually,
and I had to mask it for years and just pretend like I was fine, because when you're under 18, you don't have rights. You can be put in places against your consent. And if you say the wrong things or do the wrong things, then you'll get locked up again. But when you're an adult, it's a lot safer to explore treatment options.
What were you feeling on the inside when you were in all of these situations?
So I always felt like this weight in my chest of sadness. But I also reverted to a lot of escapism. So I would like read Harry Potter over and over again. Even to this day, I listen to the audiobooks at night because it calms my anxiety.
Yeah.
And so, like, luckily in the treatment centers, they allowed us to read Harry Potter. There were a lot of things we weren't allowed to do. Like, when I was a kid, I was an avid knitter and crocheter, but you can't have that stuff because people think you can hurt yourself. Mm-hmm. You can't have any shoes with shoelaces, like all these little things too. So like when I would sleep, like as I would fall asleep to help my anxiety, I would create stories in my head that I would follow. Mm-hmm. And then I would end up dreaming about it because I persistently thought about it as I fell asleep. So that's kind of when I started like lucid dreaming and kind of doing things. I think it's more, it's a trauma response, but it's not a bad thing to do. Yeah. You know, like it's not unenjoyable to do. It's just what it is.
What were friendships like for you as you were a teenager?
I was lucky in that I always had friends. But it wasn't like a group of friends. It'd be like one or two people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them were great. And the majority of them, the reason I got along so well with them is because messed up things were happening to them too.
Yeah.
And there was that kind of, I don't know how to describe it. It's when you meet someone and they understand or see what you're going through in a way that other people can't. Mm-hmm. I always kind of drew friends like that. I've been lucky in that I have a diverse amount of friends. However, though, like that's not to say that I didn't have my issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you formed, you formed close friendships with people where you felt a connection and you felt that there was some kind of understanding.
Yeah. Exactly.
What about people that you weren't so close to, like new people that you would meet? Was there a lot of difficult experiences for you socially?
I mean, it's like a constant level of anxiety, but I just kind of deal with it anyway. But it's not all doom and gloom. I've had good therapy too. So it's not like everything's been horrific. I just want to make that clear. Growing up, I've read a lot of etiquette books and also being taught to communicate by therapists. I know a lot of therapy lingo and like how to articulate things very well. Mm-hmm. And so I would say that's made it a lot easier, like having like a way to communicate or express what's going on.
What was some of the better help and the better support that you got where you really felt understood and you really felt that the therapeutic relationship helped guide you in whatever you wanted to achieve?
I had a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy and like group therapy, equine therapy. I went to this boarding school where you had like 48 hours of therapy a week. It felt like because you lived, you would have family, individual and group therapy nearly every day. And then you
have
alternative forms. And I've been to a couple institutions like that, and the first one was god awful, but the second one was worked out very well for me.
It sounds like very intense support, and that must have been very hard in the first one where you weren't, you know, wasn't the right support for you. What was the difference between the first one and the second one? And how did the second one work so much more better in terms of what you needed?
The difference was that one had more individualized care and enough properly trained staff, while the other one, there was a lot of unethical behavior, a lot of things going on that shouldn't be there. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it was due to like unethical behavior and lack of training. But also, like, there's something that happens in these institutions that like are quite scary. Like, it gets to a point where like the patient isn't considered like a human being at the same level. Mm. They're considered like less than, and you can see with how people treat them, they're treated as such. And so that happened a lot.
Wow. That's really heartbreaking. Must have really impacted your self-esteem if you knew that there was this underlying thing of they don't see us as equal.
So this is kind of funny, but in a really dark way. So at one of these treatment centers, for the books that we would read for school, they had us read Night by Elie Wiesel and then Hiroshima, which was like a firsthand account. So basically all these disastrous, depressing books they would have us read. But when I would read these books, I would think, okay, these people have dealt with this, this, and this, and they still grow up to become extraordinary people. So I just need to like survive and hopefully I'll be okay.
Wow. And it's quite, it was quite a thought for you to have at a young age that like, I am going through torture. I'm literally like in this place I've got no control over, but if I can get through this, I can get to the other side and I can have more control over my life or have a better life for myself.
Yeah, definitely. There was that, like as a kid, I dreamt of like falling in love and like having my own family. And because like in, like as a child, I was just very lonely. Mm. Like when I was in some of these places, I also thought my family didn't want me either. So when you feel like the people around you are against you, but also you don't have a family, it's almost like you're on your own. Mm-hmm. Like mentally, you believe that. And so once you believe that, you realize like you have to take responsibility for certain outcomes of how things are going to happen as much as one can, because like when you're a kid, there are a lot of situations where you're powerless, but meaning like taking it day to day, really, it helped. And it's hard because when you go through trauma and you have autism, it's really hard to communicate it.
Yeah.
And so like what I want to emphasize is that there's a lot of autistic people out there who have experienced a lot of abuse. If anything, they've experienced more abuse because of their disabilities. Mm-hmm. And what makes it hard and why they're a target is because of the impairments in communication that make it easy for people to get away with stuff.
When you were growing up and you were the target of, say, for example, bullies, where were your communication skills at that point in relation to being able to defend yourself or to be able to protect yourself in some shape or form from bullying?
I wasn't very polished and refined when I was a kid, so I would curse at people. I remember one time when I was being bullied really bad at school, people were calling me Vagina as my name. I must have been 10 or 11, and the cursing didn't get them to stop. Reporting it hardly got it. It didn't get it to stop either. So I just started saying, I love you every time they would tell me that.
Wow. So that's really amazing that you figured out this strategy of like not getting angry and not fighting back, because that could make it worse. When they're getting a reaction from you, you actually managed to say these like kind words. How did they respond to this?
They thought I was just kind of weird and stopped doing it. Yeah. Which I'm okay with.
Yeah.
And because like one time, like one of those boys like forced made out with me on the bus on the school ride home, and so like it was getting very dangerous, because, and like when he did that, I slapped him. And he called me a bitch, and I was only like 10 or 11. Mm. But I just don't feel like a child that young should have to defend themselves.
Yeah.
From school, at the very least, too. Yeah.
When you were 18 and you started to become an adult, how was life for you then?
It was very hard because I kind of cut ties with my family. I tried to make it work, but it just wasn't working. And I was alone again, trying to. It was very, very hard. I had a lot of bouts of depression and anxiety. I wasn't doing well in school. And I would start doing like risky behavior. Mm-hmm. And I was just really in a lot of pain. I reached out for mental health care. And I had like a therapist for a bit, but it didn't change the situation. And also like nothing seemed to be working in terms of dealing with my trauma, because like the moment I turned 18, I could tell a therapist about the sexual abuse without being taken away from things and, yeah, and like put in places. So like I felt a lot safer, but at the same time, by that age, I'd already been hurt by so many therapists and so-called clinicians and doctors that my ability to trust going into an office and rehashing my life and getting treated for it, it didn't feel worth it anymore, because I started to think like, do these therapists really have the skills to deal with this? Because I'm not just some basic person, yeah, with like a mild anxiety disorder. Like there's a lot of multi-layers that need to be addressed. And so even finding someone has been hesitant, but also that fear of becoming vulnerable again and then having someone take advantage of it kind of deters me from doing that anyway.
Yeah. And you're absolutely right. It's not every therapist is going to be skilled enough, experienced enough, or equipped enough to be able to help someone with, you know, the, as you say, that like the multi-layers of the things that you needed help with. Did you find a therapist at that point that was able to help you, or did that come much later?
They helped me as much as they could, and they were really sweet and kind. But ultimately, there's just so much messed up stuff going on that I don't think there's really anything they could have done anymore, at least that I'm aware of, that would have changed the situation. And like, I tried to do everything right. I would like have positive social interactions. I would go out with friends, do college stuff. But every night I would just come home and just cry for like no reason. And yeah, I realized that, you know, like there were more ties I had to cut before I could feel truly happy. And once I did stop talking to anyone who was toxic or had been abusive to me in my life, like it was a lot easier to feel happy. I also like met my husband when I was 20, and like life was a lot less hard after I met him, because I wasn't really alone anymore and I could start to rebuild a life like from the ground up that was more stable than anything I could have ever had as a kid.
What was it like meeting your husband, and what was it like dating and forming intimate relationships when you were younger?
Well, I met him when I was 16 at Berklee College of Music. So we're both musicians, mm-hmm, but we didn't date until I was 20. We would talk a lot long distance, mm-hmm, and I didn't like express that I was interested in him until like a few years later. I'm very calculated with what I do. Like if I decide that I want a boyfriend or a husband, like I make every aspect of myself over to accompany that in my life, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of that I did. When I moved up to Boston to take a volunteer job at a neuroscience lab, and my first week in Boston, I had a date lined up for every night.
Right. Okay.
Like, let's do this. Let's get this done. Let's like,
and so you have you're good with strategies, right?
I do. I am very calculated, because I have to be. Well, I don't necessarily know what I have to be, but you know, if you're not intentional about things, it's a lot harder to get what you want.
Mm-hmm. So does that mean that in any area of your life, if you've got a goal, you put something together that's quite structured to be able to achieve that goal?
I try to as much as possible, because like as a kid, like I was surrounded by so many messed up things And like, I didn't realize how messed up things were, but I was always able to transform my life out of them slowly. Mm-hmm. And so that made me feel like I had some power, like even though like I was surrounded by people who weren't kind, you know, there's more power in being kind when you've only been shown cruelty, if that makes sense. Yeah. And so I was also amazed about how I could make things happen. Like my whole life, I kind of believed that because of my social skills, because of my communication skills, because of how I am, you know, I'm unlovable, and this and that, but that's not really true. Those are just like stories people put in your head. Yeah. And I think if you demonstrate a relative amount of self-awareness, and you work hard, and I don't mean hard work meaning like sitting at a desk for hours at the end, but I mean doing the inside work and taking the steps in your own life, the benefits pay off, because like for most of my life I've had nothing to lose, so I've just reached, if that makes sense.
You come across as someone who's really self-aware. Did it take a long time to gain that level of self-awareness, and what did you do to help get to that place?
I was always aware of myself. I wasn't always aware of other people and kind of what they meant, what their intentions were. It was very hard for me to read between the lines. And also, like reading social cues and nonverbal social skills and all of that, that was kind of a hindrance in forming relationships, I would say.
And then what about now, reading what other people's facial expressions, reading what other people might be meaning or picking up on their emotions? Where would you say, how easy does that come to you now?
I still have my challenges, but I overcome it through like communicating. So like a lot of my autism, like what exhausts me about being out in public is I'm doing a lot of masking. Like I'm trying to find the facial expressions to match with the context of the situation, because otherwise it's going to be the same face for everything and it makes other people feel more comfortable. But it's at a cost where when I come home, I don't have any energy to do chores. I just want to pass out because I'm so exhausted.
Yeah.
So like, I still struggle with that. In my workplace, I practice radical honesty. I don't sugarcoat things, but I'm very respectful and I just say things as they are. And that makes it easier. Like if you don't have a lot to hide, there's less you have to keep track of, and you don't have to worry about keeping track of lies or, so like there's a bunch of things that happen. There's a lot of things my husband will say to me and I think it means something, but he meant it as something else. And it will cause like an overreaction because I didn't interpret it correctly the first time. So that's kind of like what my Asperger's looks like, but luckily it's becoming a lot more mainstream for people not to show their emotions, for people not to smile. My whole childhood, people kept telling me that I needed to smile. And then stuff like The Queen's Gambit comes out, which is the show with this character who's clearly autistic. And she's cool and she's a genius and she has no facial expressions and almost never smiles. And so like, there's a lot of, even in the past 10 years alone, the kind of interpretation of autism, there's a lot more autism media. There isn't as much media on institutionalized abuse.
Yeah.
Because I don't think people realize how common it is. But, you know, it just makes me think maybe in 10 years from now, all the things I had to struggle with won't be something that I have to keep hidden for other people's being comfortable around me, if that makes sense.
I really hope so. Could you give me an example of a misunderstanding in your life that you can recall where someone said something, you thought they meant something else, and there was a bit of conflict or like you felt upset over it, and you later learned, you were later able to kind of clarify what was really going on.
The funniest one that happened recently was I texted my husband and I was like, you need to take the dog out. And then he sent me a picture back of a cat that was filing its nails. And the picture said, tell me more. And so then I proceeded to make a list of more chores that I wanted him to do and said it to him, because I literally thought he meant tell me more. And so I was like, well, you could sweep, you can mop, you can do this. And he's like, you're being so annoying. I don't want you to tell me these things. And I'm like, you literally just said, tell me more.
Oh, wow. This is great. You thought it was an invitation to do like a whole list of things. How quickly did you manage to kind of iron that one out and clarify the misunderstanding?
Well, I'm very honest with my husband. If he does something that upsets me, I tell him in the moment. It's harder for me to be that honest with people I don't know as well, but because I know him so well, I've gotten too comfortable.
Yeah.
And so, like, I bicker with him and I'm like, why are you yelling at me? Why are you being like this? This is not okay. I'm your wife. I'm not a bro. I am someone, and all this and that. And then we talk it out and then we make sense of it and then it's done with.
Yeah. So your communication skills in your relationship are phenomenal. You're very transparent when you don't feel good, when his behavior affects you in a negative way, you're able to articulate it and then you can kind of get to the bottom of things quite quickly.
Yeah, I like to troubleshoot all my problems. I don't like to stay in the same problems. When I have a problem, I want to find a way to deal with it and then tuck it back and then keep progressing forward as much as one can.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you've come a really long way in terms of relationships. I'm curious about, because you said that you kind of scheduled all these dates when you were single. What were your earlier dating experiences like? Was that something that was quite uncomfortable for you initially? And was it something you kind of had to practice in order to gain the skills necessary to do better in those kind of social situations?
Well, I'm the type of person that I really need to feel a connection with someone in order to be attracted to them. Mm-hmm. And so what I really just focused on was building my friendship skills, like getting to know people. It doesn't matter if they're like a boy or a girl, mm-hmm. like getting to know them as friends first. And then usually what happens is when you become friends with someone and you're both single, or the opportunity arises where you're like, I really like this person. And if you're slightly like unattractive, it's an easier way to make your qualities seem more attractive as well. Because you fall in love with the person, not so much the looks as much. But dating's always very hard. I have a horrible amount of anxiety. Like, just to tell my husband I had a crush on him, I like drank a bottle of wine. I know that's unhealthy. I was in college at the university at the time. And so there has been a lot of that level of anxiety that I've had to learn to pull through. And I still have that anxiety in a lot of areas. And I just see my friends who are dating now, and I don't know how they do it with all of these apps. And also there's a lot of like dangerous dating going on too. Like, you could have like a date set up for each day of the week. I call it like a buffet, where you have like a new guy every night. I've never done it, but I've encouraged my friends to do it, to like get out there, because most of my friends are kind of shy and a little awkward. So like, the more dates you go on, the more comfortable you are talking to people and the less that you're as nervous. But with Roy, he was my first date of that week. And I canceled all the other dates because I just didn't really feel the need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to know, when you meet new people in your life, colleagues, friends, do you feel it necessary for you to explain your diagnosis to help them understand you more? Or do you feel that it's not necessary and people can just get to know how you are as a person.
So there, it's a double-edged sword. So usually, like, I'm lucky in that certain aspects of my resume speaks for itself. So that's what I recommend for anyone with a disability, is let your work speak for yourself instead of this whole first impression, all of this, but instead, like, have a track record of starting and finishing projects that are meaningful. There's that. And if I tell my employer that I'm autistic, which my current employer does know, it's because I got to know them enough to feel comfortable telling them the truth. Mm-hmm. And it benefits me because I don't have to mask as much, and I can ask for help when needed. And they're not like, this is a weird request, or this girl's being socially strange or anything like that. It's just understood. And there's a lot more job carving opportunities. And what I mean by that is that an employer will build a job based off of your talents instead of being like, these are the job qualifications. If you meet it, great, you're hired. If you don't, you can't be here. Instead, they like looked at my strengths and then made different job roles to accompany that. And if anything, like in my current workplace, being autistic is a strength. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a clinical supervisor now, and there are things I understand about autistic kids that they won't because they're not autistic. Mm-hmm. But I can give them that empathy. Like an example is that I'm working on a twins case right now with 4-year-old nonverbal boys. Mm-hmm. And I had my therapist not speak a word for the whole session, so they can understand how frustrating it is to try to communicate and understand like why the behavior happens that way, but also working on communicating with them without using words too.
Yeah.
So there's aspects of that that make it beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Humor. I saw your TED talk and it was hilarious. Often people will make assumptions like if someone has autism spectrum disorder, they're probably not funny. They probably don't use humor. How easy is it for you to use humor? And how does, has that always been something that you've been good at?
Well, I've always kind of been a bit witty. But in all honesty, I've used, like, if you know me, like, in my personal life and talk to me in our everyday conversations, I make you laugh naturally with the kind of stuff that I think about. But I'm not the type of person that stands up and can recite jokes and be considered funny. It's more like situational. And I use humor as a bridge to communicate difficult topics mm-hmm. to large populations. So the whole point of incorporating jokes is, yes, I do genuinely think like that, but I also, like, I'm not just funny. You know, in that talk, I talked about sexual abuse. I talked about institutional abuse. I talked about all these serious topics, but the reason people loved it is because I wasn't all doom and gloom, that I was able to add some humanity left in there. Mm-hmm. And in a way, it kind of makes me sad because so many kids go through such horrendous things that in order, they have to be funny in order for people to listen to them. To me, it's just like, I think it can develop into an unhealthy attitude mm-hmm. and also exploitation of people with disabilities, meaning, yeah. Oh, you're autistic, what's your superpower? Like that sort of mm-hmm. thing. Like, it's enough for someone to exist, and that's okay. Like, they don't, if that makes sense.
Is there anything that you've been told that you really excel at, and it's you feel it's something that has always been a strength of yours?
Talking about savantism.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that I'm a savant, but there are certain skills that I've picked up really quickly mm-hmm. By myself. Like, for example, like when I was 13 and I went into this treatment center, I taught myself how to read and music and like play piano. And I'm a really good sight reader. I'm a kids piano teacher today as well. Like, I work with a few different kids on top of my therapy that I do. And I would say that's something that I'm good at.
And that was self-taught. That was something.
I don't think I'm a savant. I wish I could, and maybe I might sometimes play it off like I'm a little bit, but I don't think I really am. But you'll read books from like Dr. Oliver Sacks, and he'll talk about cases where like a kid can look at a city for just 10 seconds and then be able to draw the whole landscape from memory in such supreme detail that it's astonishing. So you hear stories like that. I wish I was that cool. I'm not that cool. I would say I'm a very strong chameleon. If I'm in a situation, I try to adapt to it as much as possible because it makes it easier for me to navigate it. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of that too.
Yeah. So if someone has a passion that they have and they find themselves kind of speaking for quite a long time about this passion, what signs should they look out for in the other person to kind of gauge whether it might be appropriate to continue?
You have to look at facial expressions and also how their body posture is. Like, are they turned to the side? Are they kind of looking all over the place? Are they only giving one word responses? So I don't think it's a bad thing to talk about what you're passionate about, but I think you have to be around people where it's consensual, where they want to listen to what you have to say versus people who are just like, okay, this is enough. Like, and people with autism deserve genuine attention of stuff they're passionate about, but you won't get that if you just impose yourself without looking for it. There's a tendency for some autistic people to just interject themselves in things or make conversation and maybe even focus on one topic more than other people like. So what I mean by observe before you add is like watch how other people are reacting to what you say. Observe the length of which you say things and how that affects people's interpretation of you. And also, like, people can't say anything bad about you if you undertalk versus overtalk.
That's really well said, Alex. It sounds like you put a tremendous amount of work into learning all of this stuff that didn't come so naturally to you. And that gives a lot of hope for people who've got this diagnosis. How hard does someone have to work to get to the level where you're at, where you can read people very well?
As much as you can. People will improve just like in one's own life. There's always room for improvement. The only exception is if you're in a place where you're trapped, then that's a little bit harder. But meaning, like, although some kids may have not had the same experiences that I've had, and I'm very thankful for that because some of them are truly horrific. Mm-hmm. In your own life, finding ways to always improve and to have a troubleshooting system when you're encountering problems. I think that's essential to anybody really as they navigate their life.
There's one last thing that I want to ask you about, which is feeling overwhelmed emotionally. And when people with autism spectrum disorder shut down because of emotions feeling being very overwhelming, is this something that you experience? And if so, how do you cope with emotions that become overwhelming for you?
When things become overwhelming for myself, I usually spend a lot of alone time. Mm-hmm. Or I'm just with like my inner circle versus like trying to go out and talk to people. Like I retreat and I recuperate. Mm-hmm. And for some days where it's sensory, where I have these severe sensory issues, I stay in bed and I work from bed on my laptop, but it's, when I know it's going to be a difficult day, I allow myself that room to recover, mm-hmm. I guess, if that makes sense.
Does that mean that people who might want to contact you, like friends, and that might not be able to access you or get hold of you if you're experiencing those really intense feelings?
Or it's more like you have to understand where your energy comes from, like, and where your energy gets drained. And so it's more about retreating to a place where you can regain your strength, whatever form that might take.
Mm-hmm.
You never know what someone's going through. So it's not okay to be like, oh, that person's being weird.
Yeah.
Or that person's acting strange. Instead, think of it as like, there are some things they're doing that I don't understand, but that doesn't make it wrong or something that I should dislike.
Yeah. Have you got any public social media that you'd like to direct people to?
I do. I have Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and the tag is Generous Alex.
You've been listening to Private Stories Podcast. I'm psychologist Dr. Becky Spellman, and you can find out more about the work that myself and my team do at theprivatetherapyclinic.co.uk.